Michael Tilson Thomas was conducting the Buffalo Philharmonic, and that was the overture to Strike Up the Band by George Gershwin, which is as good a way to introduce Bramwell Tovey as any, not least because it's the first item in his programme of Gershwin's music with the West Australian Symphony Orchestra. I didn't have the pleasure of talking to Bramwell Tovey last time he was on the music show because I was off gallivanting and Paul Grabowski did the honours, but I'm delighted to say that I do have that pleasure right now. Welcome back to the show, Bramwell Tovey.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
Let's talk.
Glad you could make this one.
Yes, thank you. I've put myself out for this. Let's talk about Gershwin, because he's such an interesting figure, it seems to me, and in many ways sums up some of the complexities of music in the 20th century. I mean, here's this terribly, terribly famous composer who wanted to be serious. There were so many serious composers who wanted to be Gershwin. How do we unpack this dilemma?
Well, it is a dilemma, and I think Gershwin himself was in the process of unpacking it when, of course, he died tragically young in 1937. He had lessons with Schoenberg. He asked Stravinsky for lessons. He met Ravel. He knew Walton. And he did, in fact, have some rigorous music training, almost in a autodidactic kind of way. He was very self-taught. He was a Tin Pan Alley pianist who realized that he had extraordinary talent, I think, once he'd already earned a fortune. I mean, it was a unique career. So as listeners, I think we have to just really approach the music as we would any music, just listen, enjoy it, have a good time. The great, great tunes, for example, that are in the overture Strike Up the Band, they are great tunes, and this was central to Gershwin's dilemma. He wrote great songs, but he never managed to fix those great songs to a great storyline, except in the opera Porgy and Bess. All his stage musicals were sort of almost of the ridiculous variety. For example, Strike Up the Band, I think, is about America declaring war on Switzerland because of a cheese levy. You know, it's a good excuse for a piece, not. And yet somehow or other they put this stage show together with these fantastic tunes. And Gershwin, meantime, is meeting with Schoenberg and all the rest of them, attempting to increase his craft. So with Rhapsody in Blue, he didn't orchestrate it. Ferde Grofe orchestrated it, but by the time he got to American in Paris, for instance, a couple of years later, he was orchestrating his own music. Mm. So, I mean, I think it's in a sense, one has to listen to it and be prepared to accept the fact that here was a brilliant tunesmith whose orchestral chops were really developing as he died. He was thinking of writing a symphony when he died, and Catfish Row, the orchestral suite we're playing from Porgy and Bess, put together by Gershwin in almost symphonic form, was a kind of tryout. So what we're looking at here is like a person who never quite had the time to reach the limit of their capabilities. It's incredibly sad when you think how much happiness his music has given to the world. Incredibly sad that he didn't see that self-fulfillment.
It's extraordinary to think what that symphony might have sounded like, isn't it? Are we talking about long forms? Is that the quote-unquote deficiency in Gershwin's music? That's a terribly judgmental word to use.
I'm not too worried when it comes to form, because I think Gershwin, with his melodic gifts, manages to transcend those moments where other composers perhaps might die a death when their pieces got too long. Mm. But I think the symphony would have taken his work in a fresh direction. If he died 3 years earlier and someone had said, well, he was thinking of writing an opera, we'd have all poo-pooed it and said there's no way he would have understood how to use leitmotifs, how to use characterization, how to write linkage, recitative, and so on. And of course, he did know how to do all of that. So he would have written a symphony, yes, but it wouldn't have been perhaps in line with the kind of work Sibelius was doing at that time, or even Vaughan Williams or Walton. I think it would have been a peculiarly American symphony. What is terribly sad is that he had these embryonic ideas, and he wasted pretty much his last year in Hollywood writing for the movies. I mean, he was paid $60,000 a movie, so it depends on your definition of wasted. But he didn't use that time, wasn't able to use that time to simply compose the symphonic work that he wanted to do.
You're not just conducting this concert, you're also playing the piano in Rhapsody in Blue. Let's talk a little bit about that piece. I mean, you've already mentioned that it was originally orchestrated by Ferdy Grofe, the composer of the Grand Canyon Suite. It's a piece which, when you hear Gershwin play it himself, that famous piano roll, I mean, it's like twice as fast as anybody else. Do you think that that's how it should go? Is it a really fast piece?
You know, I once conducted an orchestra trying to accompany that piano roll.
Right.
And I think he must have gone, and when you read the stories about him doing stuff like this, I mean, he goes into the studio late at night, he tries to hammer out the piano roll, he's probably trying also to get it onto a 78 at certain speeds. Mm. I think, yes, you're absolutely right, the piano roll is very fast. I don't play it like that because I can't make sense of it in that way. And I actually play the piece more or less as marked. I play it in a rhapsodic kind of a way. I take the liberty of embellishing certain corners, but it's a piece that, of course, the first performance, Gershwin improvised all those piano cadenzas. It was only later that he wrote them down. So I try and make them and try and think of them as improvisations. I think there's five or six sections of orchestra, each one punctuated by a piano cadenza. So there would have been a certain freeness of spirit that would have captured the audience that first night in 1924 at the Aeolian Hall in New York. So I try and perhaps capture that freedom of spirit rather more than the tempos, which are at a breakneck speed, as you say, on the piano roll.
And I mean, jazz is a word which I don't think we've mentioned, and probably
terrible. Do you ever mention the word jazz on the ABC, or is it verboten?
We only mention it late at night. But I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, in the context of this piece in particular, Rhapsody in Blue in particular, and Gershwin in general. I mean, a lot of people think of him as a jazz composer, which is not really quite true. Where do you think the intersection between quote unquote classical music and jazz happens in Gershwin?
This is a very interesting point indeed, because Gershwin has been played by jazz musicians nonstop since his death. There isn't a jazz club in the world where there isn't a Gershwin tune played every single night of the year. And Summertime is the first song that people sit down to play with a vocalist if they don't know each other. And some of the great melodies like Foggy Day, some of the tunes we're actually doing in this concert. But of course, Gershwin was a Tin Pan Alley pianist, first of all. He was accompanying other songs. He would decorate and embellish piano parts of songs when he was demonstrating songs when he was working in his first job for a publishing company, where he actually had to play the songs so singers could hear how they went. He would embellish those piano accompaniments, but that's not quite the same as jazz. Jazz is making a creation on a foundation of harmony. Gershwin, of course, wrote foundations of harmonies for his songs, but they weren't jazz to him, what we understand to be a contemporary sense. Mm. So what we're really talking about here is a freedom of spirit rather more than anything else. And in the 1920s, after the conflagration of the Great War, as it was known then, nobody knew there was going to be a second war, it was the Great War. There was a thrill about being alive for many people. So to go to clubs, to be part of that flapper era, to be in the spirit of ragtime, which had really just emerged in the years just before the First World War, there was this freedom of spirit and freedom of approach, which I think is what we often wrongly call jazz. Jazz is a freedom of approach, yes, but it's also a musical style, and it has very, very strict disciplines. Jazz isn't necessarily a liberation unless you've got the word free jazz in front of it, the word free in front of it. And I think with Gershwin, there are one or two moments where I ask the orchestra and the music from Porgy and Bess to swing it. But otherwise, we have to play it in exactly the way that it's written. In American in Paris, for example, everything is notated by Gershwin, everything scored by him, everything written down by Gershwin, and you don't have to swing it, but you do have to play it in a very lazy fashion at times. At other times, you need to play it with that certain freedom of rhythm, which is something that is associated with jazz, but again, not strictly improvisational. So in the Rhapsody, for instance, there are moments that have this freedom of spirit, but you never take flight in it. For example, if there's a very exciting chord with a pause on it, I mean, I don't take flight on it because it feels stylistically wrong. But in the songs, when we do the songs, I treat them rather more liberally. So you're constantly trying to decide where that moment is that that freedom begins, and after that freedom, can we afford to actually play in a more jazzy spirit at certain points? It's that actually is the hard thing about performing Gershwin. Am I going to be a disciplined classical musician, which I need to be at certain times, and at other times I need to have more freedom, and at other times I really need to improvise? So it's you have to have these sort of internal committee meetings with yourself every time you approach a new Gershwin score.
Yes, I suppose so. And maybe in a way being a composer helps, because those are the same sorts of questions you have to pose to yourself as a composer, don't they? Perhaps we should, for our remaining 5 minutes, talk about Bramwell Tovey, the composer, because you've had an opera premiere since you were last on the music show.
Yes, I have actually. It was done in January this year in Calgary. It was commissioned by the Calgary Opera. It was a story of a mass murderer. Nice, cheerful story.
Mm-hmm. And, but then most operas are.
Well, you know, that's what you need. A mass murderer who killed himself but then took 5 days to die. It was perfect subject for an opera. And well, you know, composing is in a sense for a conductor who's always shepherding somebody else's music. It's very liberating to write your own music, and I've always been a composer, and although there's a great deal of jazz influence in, especially my harmony and an approach, everything is very clearly notated in my scores, and I feel that. Music is a language. It's a very important part of the way human beings communicate with each other. And as a composer, I've really wanted to communicate, in this particular instance of the opera, the essentials of the opera through the contemporary medium, contemporary language that I have as a composer. And I mean, there are other occasions where jazz can really come into its own. When I was out here last year for the Metropolis Festival with the Melbourne Symphony, we actually did a contemporary music festival which was influenced by jazz, music that was influenced by jazz, from Harrison Birtwistle's Panic to two of my own scores, including one called Pictures in the Smoke, which is very heavily influenced by jazz, but again, fully notated. The opera has flavors of jazz in the place, but in place at times. But it's essentially through composed. And the great thing about music these days is that music is all embracing. It's eclectic, whereas perhaps 20 years ago there was a feeling that if you didn't belong to the Darmstadt school of avant-garde, then you weren't really a serious composer. And when composers like Adams and Reich and Philip Glass started to emerge, there was a feeling that amongst many people that this was more about music arranging than music composition. But we've got over that rather, I think, unfortunate stance now. And what's so great now is that the avant-garde and minimalism and postmodernism, pluralism, which of course embraces so many different styles, all of these styles speak to the human condition. And so music in its plurality, excuse me, that's a hard word to say, I should have practiced that. Music in its pluralistic way, let's try that, is something that now embraces so many different styles. There's no right or wrong about it. So actually composing is actually a little easier now than it was when you were trying to beat against the fashions 20 or 30 years ago.
Yes, yes. Yes, in fact, there are very few fashions to worry about now. The music we're going to hear of yours is actually very short. It's the first variation in a piece called Variations on a Theme of Tippett. This is a multi-composer work, and it's also a piece for brass band, and all of the composers, including yourself, have a strong association with the world of the brass band. This is something which you continue to keep up, is it?
Well, I'm the artistic director of the National Youth Brass Band of Great Britain, and I find this a very inspiring job. I've been doing it for about 6 years. succeeded Elgar Howarth. This particular work that you're going to play was commissioned by Paul Hindmarsh, who was a BBC producer, and was done at the Festival of Brass at the Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester to celebrate Tippett's, the centenary of Tippett's birth. And of course, Tippett was very heavily influenced by jazz. So in my variation, I sort of bore that in mind, and the little fanfare that it's based on, the theme of Tippett's, gives us a chance to work some of the ideas into place. And my piece, my section ends with an enormous exclamation mark, and I then had to hand over to Edward Gregson, who wrote the second variation. So it was quite fun to do this project, and being a conductor, it was even more fun to me because I got to conduct it as well.
Yes, and we're going to hear the Foden's Richardson Band, conducted by Bramwell Tovey, playing. Well, we'll hear first of all Tippett's theme, which is indeed a theme that he used more than once. And then Bramwell Tovey's variation on it, and we will hear it left hanging in the air. We won't go on to the next variation.
Good thing too, yeah.
Bramwell Tovey, thank you very much indeed for being my guest on the Music Show. It's been very nice to talk to you.
Thanks, Andrew. It's a pleasure.